Welcome to Champagne Problems Podcast. I am your host, Robbie Shaw. Join us as we explore mental and emotional well-being, physical optimization, and the journey to discovering your highest self. Champagne Problems is brought to you in proud partnership with Bond Buzz, the alcohol-free social spirit. Bond Buzz is an award-winning, alcohol-free functional beverage company creating adult drinks that are health-forward, all-natural, and uncompromising. They're on a mission to create a future where feeling good and getting buzzed exist in absolute harmony and not at the expense of your health. Their bold concoctions offer focus and energy while calming the nervous system for a night on the town or a productive afternoon. Bond Buzz uses only natural ingredients and a hyperfunctional blend of nootropics, adaptogens, and functional mushrooms to amplify the sensory experience. If you're looking for a drink to help you cool off after work or a drink to stimulate your mind and body without the harmful, icky hangovers, drink Bond Buzz for good days only.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we have my good friend, former NBA star and Duke basketball legend Mike Jaminski on the show. Mike was the ACC Player of the Year in 1979 and played 14 seasons in the NBA before ending his career with the Charlotte Hornets in the early 90s. Today we're going to talk a little bit about basketball, but more importantly, we're going to get into Mike's journey around alcohol. I've been waiting to record this episode for a while, so let's go to Mike. Mike Jaminski, welcome to Champagne Problems.
Thank you, Patrick. It's taken us a while to get this together, but yeah. I'm glad I'm finally here and spend some time with you.
Yeah, man, I've been excited about this for a while, and I'm glad Robbie had something come up today, so I'm glad that we were able to do this, just the two of us. I think this will be a good conversation, man. I've known you for a long time, not as well, obviously, as I know you now, but I remember watching you play when I was a kid with the Hornets, I think the first time I met you in person was at my friend Chris Gunderman's birthday party. Kathleen Hessert, his mother, had you come and play basketball with us at his birthday, and that was the first time we met. And then, you know, my family has known you over the years, and I would run into you at Arthur's every now and then. I'm really excited that we've reconnected over the last year or so, and how we've connected, and I think that, you know, you're the perfect candidate for our show in terms of your story, and I've really been excited about having you on. So let's let it rip, man. I just kind of want to let this flow, and okay. As you know, I'm a big basketball junkie, and I'd love to hear a little bit of your backstory. I did an intro, and I think most people know who you are and your basketball history, but let's kind of go over that real quick in terms of like what your kind of childhood looked like, and then, you know, when basketball kind of took off, and then we'll just go from there.
I guess looking back on a little conflicted, and it wasn't the norm. I don't know that anybody's childhood is the norm, though. I had a father who had aspirations of being an athlete himself and fell short of those aspirations for whatever reason. And when I came along, it was his mission to turn me into a professional athlete and kind of live vicariously through me. Which, you know, you're grown up and that's all you know, and that's all you know. And, yeah. It was funny. He wanted me to be a baseball player, and genetics kept on driving me. I played all sports when I was growing up. The first real epiphany that I had, and looking back on it now, I can call it that, was when I was 11 years old. I had taken part in, I don't remember, the punt, pass, and kick competitions. And started in my dad started me on those when I was 8 years old. That was the first year that you were eligible. And when I was 11, I won the national championship.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that was my first real taste of success on a big level, and, you know, getting some media attention, even though, you know, it was in Connecticut, but still I was, you know, we're on national TV at the halftime of the Pro Bowl out in Los Angeles, and you know, getting traveling back and forth. The semifinals were in San Diego, actually. So got two first-class tickets back and forth to the West Coast. You know, as an 11-year-old, this is some, you know, pretty heady stuff. But that really showed me the level of where I could go.
Yeah.
And it also gave me a taste of national success.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I was in middle school, Little League, you know, that I was really, really good at baseball. I mean, I loved baseball. But genetics took over, and, you know, my dad was 6'8", so, you know, I kept growing. And by the time I was a freshman in high school, I was 6'7", and was starting to get recruited by basketball. I didn't play really until eighth grade was my first year organized ball. Like, we play pickup, you know, with the guys around the neighborhood, but I had some allergy and some asthma issues, so eighth grade was my first full year of competition.
Yeah.
And then a year later, I'm 6'7", I'm starting on the varsity early on in the season, and the University of Maryland comes walking in the door after my freshman season, and I'm starting to get recruited, and all of a sudden, this path, you know, I was 6'9" as a sophomore. My baseball skills started to deteriorate. And then I said, all right, this is, my path is kind of being chosen for me here, which was cool. I mean, I love ball, you know, I love playing basketball. And, but that's kind of how my athletics evolved through my childhood.
That's super cool. I didn't know about the pump pass kick thing. I wonder if you're like a, if you were like a NFL kicker in a different different dimension.
Well, I was in I do have a little small plaque in the Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, where they guess they honor all that. So
that's awesome,
you know. But it was funny, my freshman year I did the kicking and the punting on the varsity football team.
Whoa.
And I remember kicking off, it was later in the season, and running down on coverage, and I just got de-cleated by some guy. And I remember laying there on the ground saying, I think I'm going to be a basketball player.
Nice. So you're 6'9", sophomore year, start getting recruited.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any, because, you know, I want to pepper in some of the alcohol stuff.
Yeah.
Like, did you drink it all in high school, or was that,
So it
was a thing?
It was around my family.
Yeah.
My grandfather and his brothers had, they were all woodworkers, and they had a cabinet shop. And so I used to go down there and hang out when I was growing up, and my Uncle Ray used to try to give me a shot of whiskey, and, you know, Polish thing.
Rite of passage.
Yeah. And, but then, you know, I got to, probably it was in summer after my freshman year, maybe, and it going into my sophomore year, cause I was around the varsity, I was starting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was hanging out with those guys. Yeah. And we had some older guys. We had guys who were 18, 19 years old as seniors then.
Yeah, you could buy booze back then at 18, right?
Yeah, well, we had the package stores in Connecticut closed at 8 o'clock. And we had a park that we used to play in the summertime, two lit courts at night. It was cool. We had about 12, 15 guys who would come and play, and pretty good players for a small town. And but the older guys would bug out about 7:45 and go buy the beer, and we'd come back and finish playing and drink. I all through, you know, pretty much all through high school, drank beer. I remember going into Shelton, Connecticut, was this kind of down in the valley, real blue collar town. I remember going into these dive bars at 6'9" and never getting carded. Yeah. You know, I was 15, 16 years old, and just, you know, drinking beer. Yeah. And
so, you know, sophomore year rolls around, you start to get some attention. Mm-hmm. Then what happens?
My sophomore year is when things really took off for me. And, you know, I think my freshman year I averaged 15, 16 points a game, but that year I averaged 30. And really started to get some, you know, certainly statewide attention. Yeah. And then, you know, recruiting was different back then, that things really didn't intensify until your senior year. And it was then, as, you know, as that season unfolded and I saw, you know, the league we were playing in, I made the decision that I thought a freshman year in college would benefit me more than a senior year in high school. And I had to make that decision then because going into my junior year, there were a couple extra credits that I had to take to meet, you know, the state requirements. And some of those I had already fulfilled in eighth grade with some AP courses. So, I don't know. My high school coach was real happy about that, although he's I kind of narrowed it down to the schools that I was thinking about and decided that summer to go to those on my own and get a feel. I went to Davidson's basketball camp. I went to Maryland's basketball camp.
I went to Davidson's basketball camp.
Yeah, which was, Davidson was too small, you know, and Maryland was just too big.
Was McKillop the coach there already?
No, a guy named Bo Brickle was. And so Maryland was the first school in the building my freshman year, and they really recruited me hard. Probably they and South Carolina were the two that were most aggressive. And I went to basketball camp down in Maryland. Lefty was driving me around in his Cadillac to my stations and stuff. And at the time, I was thinking about majoring in journalism, which Maryland has a great journalism school, as does South Carolina and North Carolina, who is in the mix. So he goes, all right, tomorrow you have lunch with me. And I don't know if you remember the national columnists, Evans and Novak. They were nationally syndicated columnists in newspapers all across the country. And Bob Novak was a big Maryland fan. And so I walk in after morning sessions and 700 kids in the thing. And here he is sitting down, and Lefty introduces me. Yeah. And have this guy who I've seen in my paper, you know, when I pick it up in the morning. But that's just, you know, he didn't leave anything to chance. Went down to North Carolina, spent a weekend there after Davidson's camp. Then I went down to South Carolina, and matter of fact, was invited into Bobby Kremen's wedding reception. And most of the players were there, so I met everybody doing that. And
interesting recruiting tactic.
So when I was at Maryland, there was a guy who was a rising senior at Duke named Terry Chile, who saw me play, and I was tearing it up at camp. You know, I was playing really well. And so he started chatting Duke up to me. And I was like, well, you know, here's my story. I'm graduating after my junior year. I've only told a few schools that. And he said, well, I think our coaches would really like to talk with you. So that's how Duke got into the process. I met the two of their assistant coaches, came up, really enjoyed meeting them, Bob Wenzel and Lou Goetz. And then I went, I said, all right, I'm in the process of starting to arrange my official visits. You know, let's get something down here. So I put them first, because I'd seen all the other places. These, you know, my official visits to those other schools were going to be perfunctory.
Sure.
And I went down to Duke and was just blown away by everything. Coach Foster, who I immediately hit it off with, guys on the team, the direction I saw them going in, the school, you know, everything just clicked for me. And I knew when I got on the plane to go home after that visit, that's where I wanted to go. And there were three recruits in that weekend. A guy named Jim Graziano, who was the best.
Yeah, I remember.
He was probably the best high school player in the nation that year, rising senior. And Mike O'Korn, who was a teammate of Jimmy Spanarkle's at Hudson Catholic, who they thought they were going to get because of that. And I was the fourth best player out of three guys, you know. And so I got home and I called Coach Foster. I said, I'm, you know, I want to come here if you'll, you know, you'll take the chance on me. And they didn't wait for Graziano to make a decision. They took me then and there.
What was your drinking like in college?
I pledged and joined a fraternity. I was a SAE at Duke, and the dorm, the freshman where I lived as a freshman was right near their section, so I got to know all those guys. And coming from the north, growing up in Connecticut, you know, the Greek life is not a big thing. It's not anything in the Ivy Leagues. It's nothing that I grew up with. And I said, all right, I'm hanging around with these guys anyway. Might as well join.
Yeah.
But nothing, keg parties, normal beer drinking stuff.
You were playing ball so much.
It didn't affect me then. I never was, drunk in class. I never got, hammered before a game. There was never an issue, but I did drink. I didn't drink every day.
Yeah. So you're crushing it at Duke. Senior year rolls around. NBA talks start. Was it 1980?
You 1980, got drafted? Yeah, spring of 80. Like
seventh pick in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
With the Nets.
That's where my age caught up to me.
Yeah.
Finally. Because I was 16 when I graduated from high school and just turned 17 when I set foot on campus. I was 20 when I graduated and just turned 21. And the league was a lot different back then.
Yeah.
There were men playing in the league, and there were only a few rookies came in every year. So the league was old, older, and they were men. And I was still a late teen, early 20, late bloomer physically. And, that was overwhelming my rookie year.
Yeah. All right. So 86, 87, start playing for the Sixers.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the best Barkley story you got that we don't know.
Oh, man.
I know there's probably many to choose from.
All right. This was in 88. We're sitting around a practice, and after practice, and we were icing, and all of a sudden politics came up, and it was when George Bush, the elder, was running against Mike Dukakis.
Yeah.
So Barkley is telling us about the story the day before about how he bought his mom and his grandmom. They had these adjoining houses down in Leeds, Alabama. He's saying, yeah, I said, I had a tough phone call last night. And he said, I had to tell my mom and my grandmom that I was voting for Bush. And we're like, well, what happened? He goes, well, I said, grandma, I just wanted to tell you that I'm voting for George Bush for president. And they were like, Charles, the Democratic Party has helped Black Americans. You have to vote Democratic in this, in this election, and support Dukakis. And he says, Grandma, I said, I know I'm Black, but I'm rich too, and I want to keep my money.
Sounds like Charles.
So that was his initial political discussion. But I remember too when I was first down there. He and I went to remember the movie Mississippi Burning?
Yeah.
When that first came out, we went to the theater and watched it, and it had a fascinating discussion. Here I'm a white northerner, he's a guy, a Black guy who grew up in the South, and we were talking about the movie and talking about growing up and life and stuff, and it was a powerful evening.
So when you were in the league, were you drinking a lot? Mm-hmm. I know back then it was a little bit more acceptable in the alcohol and cocaine side than it was.
Yeah, I mean, I remember
more weed, but
it was mostly beer. I mean, I did discover and really started to enjoy really good wine.
Yeah,
probably about my fourth or fifth year in the league, but I can't remember during that time either. Drinking a lot of hard liquor either, Patrick. It was kind of beer, wine, and for the average person, they would probably look at me and go, yeah, he really drinks. And after a game, you're wound up, it's 10:30 at night, and you've lost a ton of weight. So we go out and have like 6-7 beers.
No big deal.
and wake up the next morning at 8 o'clock, have breakfast, go to practice, like, you know, like it was nothing.
So, you know, you have your time with the Sixers, kind of prime of your career, come to Charlotte, end your career here. You move into broadcasting for the Hornets for a little bit, then into ACC. You know, tell me about, you know, kind of give me the quick version of how your drinking progressed, because I want to get to kind of what happened and where you kind of decided to remove it from your life. And
yeah, I was, you know, and the broadcasting on the Hornet side was, it was illuminating for me. You know, we were traveling with the team, but all of a sudden you've got all this free time. You know, yeah. I'm not practicing, you know, I'm working out in the hotel, or I'm going out walking around the cities that I never visited when I was a player. You know, I'd go to museums and such, but you know, at night it was meet in the bar, have some cocktails. And this, when I really started drinking liquor, you know, was toward the end of my NBA career, mostly in the summertime, never really during the season. But then once the broadcasting started, you know, then it was vodka and cocktails and wine and dinners were, that was the broadcast teams. That's what we did on the road.
Yeah.
You know, then that turned into being at home and, you know, having cocktails later on in the afternoon. I look back at pictures, and even through the early 2000s, I looked okay. People would look at me and say, you're more than a social drinker, you know, and I would look back and say, yeah, you know,
I
completely agree. But the cumulative effect, I mean, this is going back to when I was 15.
Yeah.
You know, so, and we touched on this, and it was like, it never affected me, Well, your body is going through, is starting to have to deal with that stuff then. And, you know, so I get into my 40s, and, we had Noah when I was 38 in 98. And then things started to, probably about 2 or 3 years after that, collapse, you know, with my home life and my marriage. And that's when, in between 2000 and 2010, things, I had a spike, and things started to escalate for me, drinking, and drug use, some cocaine. I hated weed. I never liked the high that I got from weed. But coke really, that just allowed me to drink more.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be out with friends, and I was never buying it. I was always other people's stash, you know, but you know, you'd kind of start redlining it a little bit, and then you need to bring yourself back some. So I'd do a little coke and even myself out, and then start drinking again.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was in the 2000s when, you know, things were really sideways with my marriage. I've got a son who's growing up in that. And, you know, it was a dark time.
Yeah. Dark time for me too. Going through it right at the same time, pretty much. Right down the street from each other.
Yeah, no, and you know, and it's funny how, and things in my life have come full circle, and in a positive way, and in ways that I never even thought, you know, would happen. But through all that, you know, I was hanging out at different restaurants at night, and that's where I met, you know, the woman that I fell in love with. I was still married at the time, Sarah Culpepper. And, you know, we went through a bunch, but it was the first time I was happy in a long time. And really didn't, you know, drinking really kind of, I mean, we still, you know, she loved good wine as well, and we still drank, but not nearly where I was, you know, leading up to her, you know, meeting her. And so I went through another real rough stretch wherein, you know, I tried to reconcile my marriage, broke things off with Sarah. The marriage didn't, you know, that didn't work. Went back to her, and, you know, she took me back. I moved out of the house in 2011. and I was divorced in 2012, and we were engaged in 2013. So I really thought, you know, my son took a hit from that, obviously, and but where I moved was literally a half mile away from where our house was, and so he was riding his bike back and forth, and I'm not saying that it took no toll on him, but I was around him a lot during that stretch, and you know, I thought, all right, kind of made it through, you know, 10, 11, 12 years of really rough, choppy water, and things are going to even out a little bit now.
So 2015 with Sarah.
Yeah. So, you know, she was 23 years younger than me, and
I remember
I would ask her periodically, are you sure, you know, about this? You know, I'm, you know, I was like 5 years younger than her dad. And, you know, she said, yeah, you know, she's always been attracted to older men. And she goes, it's not a problem with me. And I was always worried about, you know, from 32 to 55 is, you know, that's a manageable gap.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from 57 to 80, you know, I'm kind of thinking down the road here. And I was always worried about leaving her still with a lot of her life left to lead.
Yeah.
You know, and then she started having some liver issues probably in 2014, which were the effect of drinking. You know, she was abused as a child by a neighbor and went through a lot of trauma in her own right and had trouble sleeping and was taking these. She was the type of personality, you know, if it said take 2 Tylenol PM to go to sleep, she'd take 4
mm-hmm.
or more, you know. And, you know, come to find out about Tylenol that, you know, what it does to your system, and that combined with the drinking, and she was not a big lady, you know, she was petite. And it really started to affect her liver. And we went through an initial process of dealing with that and thought we had gotten ahead of it. But it turns out we didn't. I went down to Atlanta on a road trip. She came with me at a game down at Georgia Tech. A good friend stayed down there. We went down, had an awesome weekend, came back, and then I had a game in Pittsburgh the following weekend. So I got to Pitt and was calling and had, you know, I had trouble getting a hold of her, and finally, you know, texted and talked, and she said, yeah, I just haven't been feeling well. You know, just looking forward to getting home. And I was looking forward because it was Valentine's Day. It was the 14th. So I get back and she's not in great shape. And I asked her, I said, you know, do we need to go to the ER, you know, or, you know, and she goes, no, I just need to go to sleep. And so I got her settled in. I went to the store to pick up some things, came back. Didn't hear anything from the room, so I thought she was sleeping. I didn't want to disturb her. And about 45 minutes later, I walk in, and she is unresponsive with blood coming out of her mouth. And I just, you know, I call 911. The woman there is talking me through. She said, you need to get her on a hard surface to do heart compression until the EMTs get there. So I got her down on the floor, carried her down, let her down, and got over and started the first heart massage. Blood came flying out of her mouth. And, you know, so I can't say that I'm even freaking out, that I don't even know where I am at that point. And the EMTs got there very quickly. But the police came, and so the EMTs are working on her in our bedroom, and the police are questioning me in the other room to make sure that this wasn't, you know, I didn't beat the you know, hell out of her. And, you know, they want to know my story for the whole evening. And you know, as I found out that she went into cardiac arrest twice at the apartment for 3 or so minutes plus. And they got her back. And then they went to the hospital. They went to Presbyterian about 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning at that point, and the police finally let me go. You know, they were getting walkie-talkie with the ambulance, and they said they got her to the hospital, and then they said she's stabilized. And I said, what does that mean? You know, and didn't know that they had, you know, tubed her and that she was basically on life support. She went into cardiac arrest a couple more times at the ER. And so spent the night there outside the ICU and with her, and called her family. Her family all came in, and, you know, the doctor said, you know, we can't tell you what to do, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, she's gone. You know, this is her life. And, you know, I had to make the decision to take her off of, you know, off of life support. And that was on the 15th, about noon. And, you know, the whole world changed for me. Just the trauma of that was, you know, I still live with it, you know, to this day. And, you know, and rather than do the smart thing and seek some sort of counseling, you know, some sort of professional help on the front end, than going into grief counseling or seeing some sort of spiritual counseling, you know, I decided to self-medicate. I had such amazing people in my life. But they gave me about a 2-year hall pass on my drinking. And I literally, I mean, for close to 2 years, I mean, I cried myself to sleep every single night. And I, you know, I just would start drinking and get more and more depressed. And that's how the evening went. And I cried myself until there were no more tears. And I went to sleep. I was supposed to do a Duke Carolina game the Wednesday after she had passed away. But we were having her memorial service on that Thursday. And I was in touch with my TV guys. And I'm like, you know. So Dan Bonner and I we'd switch off during the Duke Carolina game. And he came and filled in for me that Wednesday. And all of the TV people came to, mm-hmm. you know, her memorial service. And I, you know, nobody in the family could speak. And actually one of her cousins did. But I was left to me to give her eulogy. And that's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Yeah. You know, when I walked up and stood and looked out and all those faces, like thousands of different stories hit me, you know, my relationship to all those people at one time. And that next weekend was at Carolina, Georgia Tech at Carolina. And, you know, I told my guys, I said, I can't just sit in that apartment. I need to. So I knew that was going to be an emotional time because that was my first time back with my Raycom crew and all that. So I walked up to, I went to the Smith Center. It was a noon game. And a guy named Steve Kirshner, who was their media relations guy for basketball, I walked in the Smith Center. He was the only one there. And we saw each other, and he came over, and we hugged and cried, and, you know, He gave me an envelope, and I said, "Kirsch, you know, we've talked and everything." He says, no, this is for you. And it was a condolence card signed by every member of the Carolina team and every coach, and not just signatures. You know, sorry for your loss. Yeah. You know, rest in peace, Sarah. And
very cool.
You know, I met with all my Raycon people, and then, you know, we go up and meet with the coaches before before every game. And I walked into Roy's office, and he just saw me and started to cry. And we never even talked about the game. And I probably spent a half an hour up there with him just talking about, you know, you want to know where I mm-hmm. I was.
Yeah.
And that's, and I tell that, and as, you know, that's the Duke Carolina thing that people don't see, you yeah. know, and that's what I love about it the most.
Yeah.
You know, because we're there for each other. I mean, we want to destroy each other between the lines, but outside of that, you know, there's a lot of love. And what allowed me to do what I did for 14 years in the NBA, had this undying belief in myself, which really started with the punt, pass, and kick thing at 11, yeah. that I'm going to deal with this myself. And that's where my ego got in the way of treatment of a lot of things. After about 2 years, I was up at a Duke function, and my team there was like, this isn't going in a good direction. Yeah. And they tried to have an intervention for me. I was not having it.
Yeah.
Kenny Denard, I found this out afterwards. They had talked to the NBA. They had all this stuff arranged. Yep. There was a teammate, Jim Suddeth, who was going to come and drive me to Trinity. All this stuff was all arranged. And Kenny was the one but he did it over the phone. It wasn't in person. And I remember I was driving up to Noah. Was at up in Christ School, my son playing football, and I was going up to a game, and I got the phone call, and I MF'd him. I swore at Kenny up and down. I says, you know, you have no right, blah, blah, blah. You know, I had the typical negative reaction to intervention. So I pull in to this gas station right before you go back to Christ School, and I finish up the conversation, and so you go right, you go to Christ School, about 300 yards down the left-hand side, there's an ABC store, swear to God. And I was like, all right, you think I got a problem? I went down and bought a fifth, actually probably bought a handle of vodka, and went to the football game, was drinking, drank all the way on the drive home. And then at that point, I cut everybody off. I was like, all right, I don't want to hear any more talk, any more intervention, I'm going to isolate. And, you know, starting in 2017, 2018, that's when things really started to go sideways.
So you're at home drinking yourself to death.
Mm-hmm.
What was the turning point?
The best thing that ever happened to me was COVID. I was living at home. I barely got through the 2000, 19-20 season. I remember I got my last game was in March, and we had isolation in place. So I was like, all right.
Perfect storm.
Yeah, this is awesome. I mean, all I have to do is sit in here and drink, and that's it.
Yeah.
And got through that year somehow. And after the season, I'm not going to be able to broadcast, you know, I won't be able to broadcast next year if we have a season. So I started negotiating with myself. Yeah. I said, all right, I'm going to go through March Madness and drink, and then I'm going to get some, you know, we're going to address this. And then, you know, April came and it was like,
played that game.
Well, maybe I'll, you know, and my son is with me during this, he's living with me in this apartment during this whole thing. He's right on the front line, you know, and he's seeing what I'm doing to myself. And, so it's probably in June of that year, maybe late May, early June, that I was going to be, you know, the recycling bin is really filling up quickly at this point. And so the apartment we lived in, we had woods out in the back. So I was taking every other bottle and throwing them out back, you know, thinking I'm going to be real slick about this. Mm-hmm. And Noah was out walking one day and he saw, you know, of course I didn't spread them out over, you know, mm-hmm. a couple hundred yards. I was throwing them in the same place. Oh. So he finds the bottles. And so I have my every other day or every third day trip to the ABC store. And, you know, back then you have to stand outside and put your order in and go through all that. And it was a process. But I came back from the ABC store at Cotswold, and there's a table like this in our dining room with a whole bunch of dirty, filthy vodka bottles on it, and a note from Noah that said, "Dad, I love you. I want to help you." And I just, you know,
can't say no to that.
Yeah, and shame. I mean, that hits you. I mean, it just brought to my knees. And, you know, I was still drinking. We had some, you know, a lot of serious, tearful conversations. And then July 10th, I'm sitting at my normal, I've got my seat.
Your drinking station?
My drinking station. I've got my, I got my water and my vodka. And, you know, I keep hydrated during this, you know, I'm very efficient. And, so Noah comes walking out with a computer that's on, and I know what's happened, but you know, the difference is, Patrick, that I'm like begging for this to happen at this point. I'm not strong enough to do it myself. I'm not strong enough to pick up the phone and say, "Come get me." You know, I look back on it as it's me being coached and being told what to do basically my whole life,
mm-hmm.
that I needed that. And, you know, within 10 minutes of that, I'm like, you know, I was talking to these two guys down at Rebound who were doing the intervention via Zoom. And the woman who was our maid of honor in our wedding had 12 or 13 years at that point sober. You know, she had been through all this. So I didn't know that Noah, they were all
orchestrated.
This was going on for a month or so before mm-hmm. it ever even happened. I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear the message, and it was him. It was the right voice. And I was ready. And thank God for him that he could have, you know, he stuck by me through the worst of the worst. And it was funny that Chris Penn, who I worked with him when I went down into treatment, said he saw Noah's expression when I said, you know, because he was like, "What do I do if he gets up? And what if I do if he gets mad or walks out the door? You know, what am I?" And as soon as I said, "When can I come?" He was like, you know, it's like the weight of the world was taken off his shoulders. And I left, the intervention was on the 10th of July. And so they told me, he says, "You need to keep drinking."
Yeah.
You know, cause I'm the seizure risk. I got Xanax and Prozac and all this stuff in me. And so I'm, you know, my ex-wife, Stacy and Noah drove me down to treatment. I'm in the back of the car drinking vodka on the way down mm-hmm. to treatment. And I came in hot down, down in Florida. And that was the start of it.
Noah's courage to be able to intervene on you like that and set all that up. I mean, I love that story and you know what it's done and where you are now. It's incredible.
He's an old soul anyway, and I know we made him grow up quick with, you know, with what he went through, and it's not, you know, unfortunately, a lot of kids and, you know, grow up with divorce and, you know, have to deal with a lot of stuff. And, but, you know, for him to, you know, and the thing, Patrick, even from, from a very early age that we always had a great line of communication. And I think there were things that I learned from my growing up. And it was hard for him to grow up in the state of North Carolina with my last name.
Yeah.
There was a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah.
And we had to navigate through a lot of stuff. And we did because we always could talk to one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably why he was able to do that too.
You know, fast forward when I came back after 2.5 months, he stayed with me.
Yeah.
You know, just to make sure, you know, he wanted, and I'll never forget that hug when he saw me when he came down to pick me up when I was finished down in Florida.
So how long has it been now since you've had a drink?
Well, my last drink was July 13th, 2020. So that was, yeah, that was the vodka.
4 years.
Yeah. And I remember just being in such a state of calm and peace that even that first day down in the immersions,
it was over.
Then it was over.
Yeah.
I was being medicated. I wasn't white knuckling this thing.
Yeah, you got the help that you needed.
Yeah, it was uh-huh. clinical. It was funny. I go in there for the first night. They get me into my room, and there's a woman who's there, sitting there watching me, or sitting there in the room with me. So it's going to be about 9:30, 10 o'clock. Yeah, I'm like, you know, ma'am, I think I'm doing pretty well. You can go if you want. She goes, oh, no, I stay here. And they had somebody in the room with me 24 hours a day.
Yeah,
for first 5 or 6 days that I was down there. And they're coming in and checking my vitals every 4 hours. You know, I got to the point where I didn't even wake up for it at night. You know, they're just coming and do my thing. But I did an initial 7-day taper. that didn't go as planned. Yeah. So I had to do an extra 4 days. And that got me to the point where they could release me to rebound.
Yeah. Yeah. So you stayed down there a couple months, came back to Charlotte.
And
how are you doing now? Like, what are you in terms of? Well, I know, but for the for the listeners, like, what is your, you know, what keeps you sane? What fills your cup?
When I came back, I was originally going to go down there for a month. And talking about coming full circle, Jason Williams, it's his place, and I had him as a rookie with the Sixers teams. And he was,
we got to get him on, man. His story's pretty wild too.
Yeah. And so it was kind of, again, this full circle thing of coming to, you know, me trying to, you know, his dad telling him midway through his rookie year, he says, why don't you hang around with G-Man more than Charles? And he wasn't hearing it, but, you know, for me to go and find sobriety, you know, in a place that he started, was really
pretty cool.
Pretty cool and pretty amazing. Like all the, you know, like providential God was guiding me through all this. And so I came back and I was down there from July until the end of September. And then I came back and did an outpatient via Zoom here in Charlotte for 6 months, and I went, the basketball season started that next year, and I went through a full year of broadcasting, my first year, and sober. I hadn't gotten to a year yet. And everybody was so incredibly supportive of me, and you know, got, and I was on a good trajectory. It was early, but I felt good enough to, you know, that I needed again to go back to work and get into this rhythm again, you know. And for the people there, my Christianity has been a huge part of my recovery. And, you know, I've been thinking about this recently too, that when going to church service was part of our group down in Florida. Yeah. on Sundays. And I really, it took me a year to get my head cleared out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if I had thrown myself into my faith immediately, I don't know that it would have had the same effect.
Yeah.
I started to get introduced to it, and then it was probably a year and a half into sobriety that I really started to embrace Christ and embrace, you know, the Bible and my study and, you know, and that spiritual side of me. And for 2 years, I went back down to Rebound and worked there as a peer mentor. I was somebody who had been through the program and I was the mediator. I was kind of in between the therapists that we had running the groups and the people who were new into the program. And yeah. I was, you know, a lot of times I'd get the conversation going. I'd lay myself open and, yeah. you know, get them to talk about things and, you know, to feel comfortable about that. And then, this 2023, I got through the broadcast season and I said, you know, I really would like to come back here to North Carolina. And this is what I see myself doing. I want to help, but I want to reach more people. Yeah. You know, I was that experience as a mentor down at Rebound was really incredibly important to me and my growth and my sobriety.
Yeah.
During that time, but I was only touching two or three people at a time, you know, and I thought that, you know, maybe there's, you know, I can broaden my horizons back here a little bit more. And then we met.
Here we are. Cool.
And for me, you know, one thing Christ talks about is to be thankful in every circumstance. And, you know, I can look back and see every, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for, you know, I look back at the life that I've had, the, you know, playing in the NBA, playing at Duke, stepping right into broadcasting. You know, I've never written a resume in my life. I've never had a break in this. I just finished my 30th year broadcasting.
It's crazy.
You know, it's just, it's a dream. I mean, it's something that I worked extraordinarily hard for, you know, along the way, but still, I mean, you know, to look at that life and, you know, there are no complaints, but now to use a really dark time in my life as something, a new working with you and working in this, in the recovery field, at my age, to find something that you're passionate and feel something like that for that's brand new to you is
such a gift.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have so much respect for guys, you know, that are in situations like you that have, you know, kind of lived a really incredible life and then decide at a later age to, you know, give up alcohol and really live the last, mm-hmm. you know, last bit of their life with a, you know, a vigor to serve. And
and I've seen, you know, it was funny that I was on this horrible track to an early death with my drinking. Yeah. And I just needed, because everything really, all the discipline and focus and everything that made me a great athlete made me a drunk.
Yeah.
You know, I needed to get over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into treatment and I got sober. And now all those things that are inside me are working toward my sobriety.
Yeah.
And my faith. And I just had to get off, yeah. you know, get over into this other track. And, you know, so that, and just the, you know, the small exposure that I've had to it, you know, with you and through church, and having people come up to me and tell me that, you know, my story has touched them or touched a family member, or have people come to me to coach them through some things. You know, that purpose that God is using me, using me for now, more than, this is now who I am. You know, that's the other stuff is what I did, and that's what people know me for. And look, it's given me a great platform. You know, it's really given me a voice to do what I'm doing. But this is now who I am.
Well, man, this is exactly what I, envisioned this conversation to be like, man. And I'm so glad to call you a brother and a friend. And it's we got a lot of good stuff ahead of us. And thanks for sharing your recovery with everybody.
Yeah, no, and that's, to me, it's funny. And they were doing a HBO Real Sports with Brian Gumbel was doing a feature on Jason and what he's doing down at Rebound. And they had found out that I was just newly through that program. And so the producer said, do you think Mike would? So I talked with them, and he goes, would you mind, would you come on the record? And I was like, yeah. You know, because a woman named Mary Carrillo was the reporter doing the feature, and I've known Mary for years. I used to go to the U.S. Open tennis up in New York all the time, and I trusted her. I felt good about sitting down, and that was the first time. That was in March of 2021. That it hadn't even been a year in sobriety yet, and here I am telling HBO what I just went through. But it was really empowering for me to be able to do that. And that experience got me extremely comfortable with being completely honest about.
Yeah. And it keeps you accountable too.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that I'm like this human. I'm not trying to inflate my own importance by any means, but I'm like this human billboard that's out there walking around. People know my story. They know me. They're looking at me.
Yeah.
You know, how is he living his life? How is he conducting himself? And that's great. I mean, I embrace that. And that's, again, it goes back. It's been kind of my whole life has been that in another fashion.
I love it when we're out in public and people come up and say, hey, man, you look like Mike Jaminski.
I do favor him a little bit, but when you touch somebody's life, that's, very popular. It's very, very powerful.
Well, thanks for doing this today, man. I love you.
Yeah, I love you too, man. Yeah. This is
been good.
Talk about coming full circle with, I was your uncle Bob's best wine customer for a long time, and all the people I knew in Charlotte.
Well, now we're trying to put his ass out of business.
Yeah, right. But and like you said, you knew of me, you saw me play, and I didn't know you growing up, and we actually had a mutual friend, Allison Dellinger, who said you guys should have lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And we did.
Yep. Very grateful for that. All right, man. Well, that's a wrap.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool.
We'll do it again.
Yeah.